Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:40 p.m. on Monday, April 16th, 2015. Present today, we have Representative Vice Chair Sadler, Representative Edgman, Representative Gaddis, Representative Pruitt, Representative Wilson, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Guttenberg, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Thompson. Before we start, please turn off your cell phones. They interfere with the recording equipment. On today's schedule, we'll have our second hearing on House Bill 135, and if it's the will of the committee, I intend to move this bill today. We'll also have our introductory hearings on House Bill 155 and House Bill 15. I do not intend to move either one of these bills from committee today. First bill up today is House Bill 135, an act establishing Roth contribution program for the public employees deferred compensation program and providing for an effective date. We'll be taking public testimony on HB 135 also. Here today to present House Bill 135 is John Boucher, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Administration, and Kathy Lee, Chief Pension Officer, Retirement and Benefits. Mr. Boucher, Ms. Lee, please come to the table, put yourselves on the record, and refresh the committee about House Bill 135. And we've been joined by Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Boucher. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Administration, and joining me today is our Chief Pension Officer, Ms. Kathy Lee. We appreciate the committee hearing the bill at the last hearing, and we're available for additional questions if you'd like at this point in time.
Okay. Questions from the committee? By golly, seeing no questions, at this time I'm going to open up House Bill 135 for public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 135? Seeing none, is there anybody online? Seeing none, then at this time I'll close public testimony on House Bill 135. Is there anyone else who'd like to, there's nobody else who wants to testify on 135? Pretty simple bill. That brings House Bill 135 back before the committee for discussion. Any further discussion? Representative Munoz.
I have not discussion. I could give you a motion to move the bill if you'd like, or we can wait.
If there's no further discussion, then I would entertain that motion. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move House Bill 135, Version A, with attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Any objections? Seeing none, House Bill 135 moves from committee. We'll do a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. Thank you both for being here today. Okay, we're back in session. The next bill up today is House Bill 155, an act establishing, well, that's the one we just finished. What am I doing here?
Do it again.
House Bill 155.
Yes.
28th Legislature, we passed and defined indirect expenditures as foregone revenue. The legislation set forth a requirement that certain reports identifying potential loss of foregone revenue. And earlier this session, this committee received an overview of the legislative finance indirect expenditure report that identified certain credits, fees, discounts, and deductions that should be terminated. House Bill 155 repeals those indirect expenditures with an estimated increase of revenue by about $450,000. The indirect expenditure repeal in House Bill 155 were selected for repeal for various reasons that range from the expenditure did not meet legislative intent, had limited benefit or usage, and were obsolete due to inactivity or replacement by electronic filings. Any questions from the committee for me or Mr. Anderson, also available to answer questions on this bill, or Jerry Burnett, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue, and Ben Brown, Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. They're in the room also. And I'm going to have Mr. Anderson take over and do the heavy lifting on this.
Thank you, Co-Chairman. For the record, my name is Brody Anderson, legislative aide to the co-chair, Representative Thompson. Like the co-chair mentioned, HB 155 is the next step in addressing foregone revenue to the state identified in the 2015 indirect expenditure report. HB 155 repeals the following indirect expenditures. I'll give the name of the expenditure and the page that they are found on in the indirect expenditure report. The first one is the small loan company business license exemption on page 3. The Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission reduced permit fees found on page 48. The CFEC, which is the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission's reduced application fee, found on page 50. The CFEC's reduced expediting fees on page 51. The CFEC's reduced transfer fees, found on page 52. The Exploration Incentive Credit, found on page 97. The tobacco product tax deduction for timely filing on page 141. The cigarette tax stamp discount found on page 142. The motor fuel tax timely filing found on page 143. The large passenger vessel gambling tax deduction found on page 163. And the tire tax discount for timely filing found on page 167. And at this point, I'd like to walk the committee through the different sections of the bill. Starting at Section 1, it adds a new section to AS 1643-100 to address the removal of the low-income permit fees and requires that the CFEC to issue permits at the same cost to all permit holders. Section 2 amends AS 1643-160A, requiring that the commission to make each person pay the same fee with the exception of non-resident surcharges. And the reason why that exemption is in there for non-resident is to ensure compliance with the Carlson decision. Section 3 removes a reference to AS 3805-180I, which is the exploration incentive credit, from AS 4109-010A. Section 4 removes references to AS 3805-180I from AS 4109-0110B. Section 5 removes references AS 3805-180I from AS 4320-043G. Section 6 amends 43. Thank you, Representative. Section 6 amends 4355-210 to disallow the deduction for federal taxes for the purposes of calculating the state tax on large passenger cruise ship gambling activity. Section 7 amends AS 4340-10C by removing language that allowed motor fuel dealers to retain a portion of the motor fuel tax due to cover expenses for filing the motor fuel tax return. Section 8 removes references to 4350-540 from AS 4350-590A to conform with the repeal of 4350-540C. Section 9 removes references of the exploration incentive credit from AS 4355-11M to conform with the repeal of the exploration incentive credit. Section 10 removes references to the exploration incentive credit from AS 4355-023A, once again to conform with the repealing of that credit. Section 11 removes, once again, AS 3805-180I from AS 4355-023L to conform with the repealing of that credit. Sections 12 and 13 are the actual credits the actual statutes and codes that are being repealed, and I'll go through the list of them. AS 062003OC is the subsection that allows the license fee for the small loan company license to replace the Alaska business license. AS 1643160D is the subsection that establishes the reduced fee for low-income permit holders within the CFEC. AS 3805-180I is the subsection that establishes the exploration incentive credit. AS 4109-030 is the section that references the relationship between the exploration of incentive credit to Title 41, Chapter 9, which is public resources in the oil and gas exploration incentive credits. AS 4350-330B is the subsection establishing filing deduction in the excise tax on tobacco products. AS 4350-540C is a subsection that establishes the discount within the cigarette tax stamps. AS 4350-540H establishes the definition of what a stamp is eligible for the discount. And finally, AS 4393-025E is a subsection that establishes the deduction for filing and the tire fees. Within the codes, we have three repeals. 20AAC 0525B is the code that establishes the reduced fee for low-income permit holders. 20AAC 05425E subsections 1 and 2 is the code that establishes the reduced fee for expediting fees for low-income permit holders. And finally, 20AAC 051910H is the code establishing the reduced fee for the transfers. Finally, Section 14 provides transitional language related to the repeal of the exploration incentive credit and the CFFEC low-income transfers. Section 15 is the effective date of January 1, 2016 for the gambling tax activities, and that's based off of the federal tax calendar year, and that's because the gambling tax is paid annually. Section 16 is the effective date of July 1, 2015 for all other sections of the bill, and that is to comply with the state of Alaska's fiscal calendar, and that's because all other related fees, discounts, and deductions are calculated on a monthly basis. Thank you, Co-Chair Thompson. This concludes my walkthrough of HB 155.
Okay. We were joined at the beginning of the presentation by Co-Chair Representative Newman. We have some questions, and you also know the other people that are in the room that I'll have some questions for them also. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I love this bill. However, I now represent District 3, and you don't, so you might want to change that on there. Or you could put my name on the top. Either way works for me. But this is a great bill. I just wanted to point that out.
That was a simple question to answer. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here. Mr. Anderson, can you tell me out of these, it looks like 8 total indirect expenditures out of the big book that we got at the beginning of session. Can you tell me if there's any indirect expenditures that were listed as recommended termination and aren't currently in this bill? Or are they all here?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, The ones that are not included, there were ones that were recommended for termination, and those dealt with the corporate income tax. And when you look at the corporate income tax, with throughout the indirect expenditure report, you see that there was, I think, roughly 3 to 4 that were recommended for termination. Then there was a very large chunk of them existed within the policy review and also reconsideration component. So I believe the sponsor felt like those should be looked at more in a comprehensive approach rather than piecemeal some of the easier ones, but we should look at it as a whole and how it impacts that tax structure in its entirety.
Revise the whole thing. Representative Kawasaki, follow up.
Just a brief follow up. The way I understand this, the finance analysis, that's our own legislative finance division's recommendations that either continue, modify, or terminate, and based on a couple different items. That's from us. I mean, basically, that's the legislative finance division. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, yes, the recommendations came through legislative finance. The numbers were calculated through Department of Revenue, but the recommendations are from Leg Finance.
And then one follow-up. Has the Department of Revenue had any comment as to whether those recommendations are good recommendations? Like the one for has legislative intent been met, those types of things. Since there are recommendations, our recommendations might differ from Department of Revenue. Did they have a chance to weigh in on whether those were good recommendations?
We're going to have Jerry Burnett come up and possibly step into this also.
I like this.
Wade, I guess, yes.
Well, I didn't actually mean to show up here today, but for the record, Jerry Burnett, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. And I think the question was, have we had an opportunity to look at this? And clearly you see that we have a fiscal note on the bill. We have had discussions about this. I think the recommendations that are in the bill are ones that we have no problem, certainly have no problem with. They're fees that taxpayers were able to withhold in return for filing their taxes. There are also some obsolete or unused oil and gas tax credits that are in the bill.
Follow-up? Thanks. I guess, you know, I understand the ones that have never been used or the estimated revenue impacts are zero. It seems just smart to take those off the books. For the ones that actually have revenue impacts, though, so the department's comfortable with the comment that some of these recommended terminations are because of low usage or small benefit. Is that what the department's saying then?
Through the chair to Representative Kawasaki, I would say that to those comments, yes, we're on with those.
Mr. Burnett, I'm curious on the fiscal note that we have. Why are we seeing a $50,000 fiscal note on bills that require a contractor to work program changes to the Tax Revenue Management System, TRMS? We also saw this same thing, $50,000 fiscal note on HB 158. The OTI charge seems kind of high, $50,000.
Representative Thompson, I would have to go back and see exactly what, and that's an estimate from the contractor, but every time you make a change, we still have the contractor doing work, whether it's exactly the $50,000 or some other, and if other bills were passed, it may affect what we end up having to spend also. So it's our best estimate of what the contractor is going to charge us for this. At the time.
Okay. Representative Pruitt, do you want to follow up with Burnett? Or I think Representative Gaddis has a direct question to him.
I had a question for Mr. Anderson.
Okay. Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Burnett, you brought it up, so we'll just fall into it. So, specifically, the tire tax comes to mind. And so, you know, there's a bill out there to move the tire tax date to the end of the month. and now we have 50,000, if you will, and certainly doesn't work on that specific form, but I certainly hope that tire tax, if you will, that form, that we can really get into the weeds with the folks that actually do the taxes and literally collect only the information we need to collect. And I know that, you know, kind of went through this at our, when we talked about the tire tax, but I really do hope that if we're going to spend $50,000 to look at forms and redo how we do it, that we really look at collecting only the information that the state needs in order for taxes. So,
okay, through the chair to Representative Gaddis, I have discussed this with the deputy director of our tax division, and I think you may have had a response from him too, but I think we're committed to doing that very thing, and I think there were some legitimate concerns raised here previously about the amount of information collected on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Burnett, you have a $50,000 in the fiscal note. My question was, what if your costs on this are $30,000 or $40,000, come in less than $50,000 on this? I don't see anything in here that talks about actual costs and where we would work on that. So if they come in less than that, how do we see that, or where do we see that in the fiscal note, that the department just doesn't get the $50,000 when it doesn't cost that much?
Through the chair to Representative Newman, the fiscal note would, assuming it was passed, would appropriate $50,000. So if we spent less than that, that would be something that we would have to look at through the year and work with your legislative finance to either lapse that money or have a negative supplemental in the following year.
Okay, I'd like to suggest we work on the fiscal note and look at that.
Okay.
Representative Newman. On the same subject, Representative Guttenberg.
Not on the fiscal note, but for Mr. Burnett.
Okay.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the oil and tax production royalty, in this page, which I think is page 97 out of the book, the bottom line is a recommend termination. The credit appears obsolete and ineffective, given that it hasn't been used in over a decade. The alternative credit for exploration, 4355025A124, appears to be a more attractive incentive. So you have two incentives here on the table, and they're using one of them almost exclusively, and the other one languishes, not being used. But what's the policy change that both produce different things, incentives? But which one should the state actually be enforcing? Maybe the one that hasn't been used is the better one for the state, and they're using one with less restrictions, with their ability to do other things. You know, the state's trying to drive some behavior with these incentives. What are we losing when we just get rid of the other one? Maybe we should be getting rid of the one they're using because we want them to use the one that they haven't been using.
Through the chair to Representative Guttenberg, I'm not prepared to answer that question right now. I think it's something that could be discussed through resources, but I believe the 025 credits actually came after the one that we're getting rid of, so I believe that there's been a discussion ongoing as to which credits need to be in place, and the other one was simply left there. So.
Okay, we'll go there another time. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you. So this question is for Mr. Anderson. In terms of the policy here, we're related to those where we are giving that incentive to take certain actions. I see that we're taking away, and specifically the one I'll reference is the Section 7 where we're talking about the motor fuel tax. See, we're taking away that incentive. But is there any consequence to them not doing it? I think the idea was, I mean, there's two ways to go about it. We can either incentivize them to do it on time, or we can penalize them for not doing it. Have we, at this point in time, are we just removing that incentive and there is no penalty, or should we consider that?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I would not be able to answer that question at this time. We still have Mr. Burnett up here who might be able to answer it on a technical basis.
If it's okay, can I, Mr. Burnett?
Go ahead.
Through the chair to Representative Pruitt, all of the taxes have penalties for late filing. So there would be a penalty and interest costs assessed to anyone who files late. One of the differences between when this incentive went into effect and now is the ease of filing. Now people are able to file online. Records are electronically kept in most cases. And so filing taxes should be less of a burden for the taxpayer than they were at the time that the original incentive was put in place.
Okay. So follow up on that?
Yes. By the way, I was a little remiss in not recognizing Representative Garrett for being here. Thank you. Representative Pruitt, go right ahead.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, so currently we have in place both an incentive and a penalty. And I want to make sure that I understand the historical context. I think I understand it, but I want to make sure that I'm clear. Historically, it was an incentive because it was so labor-intensive before we were utilizing the computer systems. Now we've invested in that infrastructure. It's available. So the incentive is not viewed as being as necessary at this point in time. It doesn't add the same weight that it did in terms of actually the cost of the business as it did before.
Through the chair to represent Pruitt, I think that's largely true.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Munoz.
Thank you. For Mr. Burnett first, what is the amount of the gambling tax that we bring in? 33%.
Through the chair to Representative Munoz, I don't have that number off the top of my head right now. It is in the millions of dollars, but
find that number. I'm sure.
But I can find that number and get it to you.
And then a follow up for Mr. Brody. Why did you determine to remove the deduction for federal taxes on the gambling proceeds?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz. Through conversation that we did have with Department of Revenue, the normal tax structure deductions, usually it's, you know, state taxes are deducted from federal taxes and not the other way around. It happened that the gambling tax was one, I can't speak if it's the only one, but it was one of the few that had it federal taxes where you'd be able to be deducted from state taxes. And so to get more in line with the regular tax structures that we have set up in the state, that's why the move was suggested.
And so follow up. Just for understanding, though, then we are collecting, we're assessing the tax on the federal portion as well.
Hmm. Representative Munoz, I don't know if Representative Burnett might be better prepared to answer.
Representative.
I mean, excuse me.
No demotion, sir.
You've been demoted.
Excuse me, through the chair. Representative Munoz, Mr. Burnett might be able to answer that better. I don't fully understand the question.
Through the chair to Representative Munoz, I think what you're asking here is when we assess a tax, it's on all of the revenues earned on gambling in state waters, right? And under the current structure, the federal tax paid on that is deducted from their income prior to paying the state determining the state tax. And this change would make it so the state would tax on the entire revenue. The federal government would tax on the revenue less the state tax, which is similar to how nearly all of our other taxes are done. So for our state, corporate income tax is deductible from the federal tax, but it's paid on the full adjusted revenue or income allocated to the state. So.
Thank you. I understand how it would be calculated, but it does put the tax on the federal portion, and I can't imagine that it happens in other examples, but maybe we'll talk about it further
okay.
After the meeting. Thank you.
Representative Edgman.
Thanks, Mr. Co-Chair. I had a question for CFEC, if I could get them to come to the table at some point here.
Ben, come on up. Place yourself on the record.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Benjamin Brown from the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission.
Go ahead, Representative Edgman.
Thank you. So,
what page?
Well, I'm on page 48, in the back of the material. And my question, I think, is just to get a summary of where those 233 individuals come from. Is it like one area of the state, or is it just sort of scattered around the state? Just to get a better understanding of.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, to respond to Representative Edgman, I don't have a breakdown, and it was 216 in 2014. We've updated since we did the foregone revenues analysis last year. So it's about 200 up to 220 for the past 5 years. They're probably mostly from rural Alaska, and I can certainly try to go back and get a specific answer to you on that, but that would be my anticipation is that, you know, in the great scheme of our permit renewals, 200 people isn't that many, but if you're the person who needs the hardship, then obviously it affects you very directly, and I'm going to guess that they're going to be clustered in rural Alaska.
Follow-up, Representative Edgman.
Through the chair, I don't think I'm necessarily going to oppose this part of the bill at all, but it would be interesting to know what the additional costs are that are being incurred here, or, you know, sort of being placed upon an area of the state that probably is pretty low income to begin with. And are we talking about you know, is it $50, $100, something like that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edgman, it's 50% of what the fee would be otherwise, and our fees go from $75 to $3,000 under the current statutory and regulatory formula that exists. So, you know, if you have a $3,000 fee and you're getting a $1,500 reduction for poverty, that's a significant benefit if you can actually demonstrate that you live at or below the poverty level. If it's a $75 fee, as my mother always used to say, everybody has $10 unless you don't, and then $10 is a lot of money. So it's all relative, and I think everyone respects that here. Certainly I could try to find out. The aggregate amount for over the past 5 years on average would be $17,686, and in the great scope of the fees that we collect, that's not that much. But for the individual fisherman, it could be a hardship. So it would take a little while, but I could probably find the geographic breakdown of those 216 applicants, renewing people in 2014. And I could probably also find out, you know, obviously, if I'm going to find out where they're from, what the specific fee they were getting 50% off of was. But I don't know how quickly I can turn that around, how soon this is going to be back up before the committee, but I can certainly look into it.
I know that Mr. Brown's been working with my staff on this very issue, in fact.
Yeah, and Mr. Kocher, I just want the record to reflect that we did discuss it. And if, you know, it sounds like there isn't an inordinate increase involved here just by doing the sheer math of it all. But I just want the record to show that we talked about it, and if in fact there is an inordinate increase, then that would cause you know, some issues. But to the extent that the commission might be able to look at this, and I wouldn't ask for a lot of work and identify every single one of them, but just sort of broad trends, or most of these, I'm going to guess, are probably from the AOIK region. That's what I'm guessing. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I have Mr. Burnett up at the table?
I will let him take the hot seat back.
He can have one over on that.
He can be at the left hand.
That way we can.
Very good, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Burnett. Through the chair, I would like to get an answer to something that we've talked about, and I think none of us know what the answer is. So here's the question. Right now, is there any other tax besides this one that's being rectified here where somebody gets to deduct their federal taxes before they pay their state taxes?
That was the question, I think, that was asked to you.
Right. Through the chair to Representative Guerra, I'm not aware of any in the state.
Fair enough.
And follow up, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, through the chair. And I'm sorry I was late. You can...
So noted.
You can yell at Representative Kawasaki if this has been asked already. There's the reference to removing the tax credit in 3805-180I. And I see reference in the backup materials that there's another exploration tax credit that's never really been used, but that's not the 3805-180I one. So what's the 3805-180I one? And Representative Wilson tells me they already explained that.
3805-180I.
I mean, there's the 4305095 one, which has never been used or hasn't been used in many, many, many years. I understand that. Is that the same as the 3805181?
You referenced the sections.
Oh, it's on page 97 of what's not really page 97.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, AS 3805180I does reference the exploration incentive credit, which is reflected as the statutory authority for the exploration incentive credit. And then the references to Title 43 are removing the reference to AS 3805 from the oil and gas production tax components of that title. The other exploration credit that is listed is on page 106 of the indirect expenditure report. You have the alternative credit for exploration, which has its authority in AS 4355025 subsection A1-4, which is the one being utilized on a yearly basis.
Chairman, can I ask Representative you ask the witness to Mr. Brody, to Mr. Anderson, to reference what section of the bill? Trying to flip through the 20-page bill to find those statutory references is difficult. If you could reference the section of the bill, that might be helpful.
Absolutely.
It takes time to breathe in between.
The first through the chair, Representative Sadler and Representative Guerra, the first section that references the expiration of incentive credit is section 3, which removes the reference of AS 3805180I from AS 4109010A. Section 4 then removes the expiration of incentive credit from once AS 4109010B. That's section 4. Section 5.
Go ahead. Don't mind me. I'm just trying to follow.
Section 5 removes the exploration incentive credit from Title 43-20-043G.
Mr. Chair, can I deal with my confusion?
Go ahead, Representative Guerra. I didn't hear you.
Oh, thank you. So I'm trying to read both the statute and the parts of the revenue report that you distributed. The one on page 97 of the revenue report, the title is 4305095 Indirect Expenditure Exploration Incentive Credit. On the page, it says this one hasn't been used in over a decade, 4305095. But what's being repealed is the Section 38 credit. And so, and I don't see any reference to that in this revenue book.
Right here. The title is 4305095.
I realize that we've thrown a lot of information, and it's going to be a little confusing. I wish that all of you would be able to, if you need to, get a hold of Mr. Anderson. If you have any questions, Mr. Burnett, please follow up. If you want some questions answered, please get a hold of my staff. We'll make sure we get the answers, and we'll get them out to everybody so we'll all have the answers together. But go ahead.
Thank you, sir. I'm sorry. Then folks on both sides of me are reading stuff to me, but it seems backwards. So I just want to make sure we're not getting rid of the wrong credit.
You're backwards.
The title says on page 97 that we're talking about the exploration incentive credit. That's 4305095. That's what it says.
No. Submission per, they're all 943.
Oh.
This is according to AS 4305095, which was the bill we enacted last year. They had to go back and look at the indirect expenditure names, and that's what you're reading. The actual authorization is under number 2 there, 3805.
Thank you for the clarification, Mr. Pruitt. Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pruitt is right. So,
I'm glad we're all in agreement here.
That's And then if you could just humor me and just confirm, Mr. Burnett, that the 3805-180i exploration credit has not been used in over a decade?
Yeah, to the chair, Representative Gary, that's correct.
Okay. Henson. Great.
All right. Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, as I said, if anybody wants some more clarifications, because this was rather complicated, fast, and long, please get a hold of my committee, and we'll get answers for you, and at the same time be able to get those answers out to the rest of the committee members so they'll be up to speed also. Okay. Any closing remarks, Mr. Anderson?
Thank you.
All right. At this time, I'm putting House Bill 155 aside.
I'm decaf.
Our final bill for introduction today is House Bill 15, an act relating to credits towards a sentence of imprisonment for certain persons under electronic monitoring by Representative Wilson. Representative Wilson, please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation. Is this version G? Let's make sure here.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, it is.
For the record, my name is Representative Tammy Wilson. I represent District 3, North Pole. Sorry, I had to put that on the record. Mr. Chair, this started out as a very simple bill. As I learned through judiciary, there is no such thing as a simple bill. What the intent of the bill is, we are talking about pre-sentence, okay, those who have yet to be found guilty of anything. At this time, if you are pre-trial and you don't get out for any type of reason, maybe you can't make the bonding, you don't want to do electronic monitoring, you might not be able to find a third party, all sorts of reasons, and you go to jail while you're awaiting your trial, you get time served for every day you're sitting in jail. What HB 15 does is put special provisions around if you were to be on electronic monitoring. And as you will see, it says, if the person has not committed a criminal offense while under electronic monitoring, we're on page 1, line 12, and the court imposes substantial restrictions on the person's freedom of movement and behavior while under the electronic monitoring program, including the requiring the person to be confined to a residence, and we changed residence from a private home because there are a lot of halfway houses up there out there. There's some new ones coming now that will help those find a job. Maybe they don't have a place to live yet, have counseling as part of it, so it wouldn't necessarily be a private residence, so we didn't want to count those helps out. If you turn to page 2, these are the things that the courts can then determine while you're there, as you have in front of your charge, to be at court appearances, meeting with counsel, or a period during which the person is not at a location ordered by the court for the purpose of employment, attending an educational or vocational training, performing community volunteer work, or attending rehabilitative activity or medical appointments. In our system currently, especially if you're just pretrial, there really isn't any ability for you to be able to get treatment. Most have lost their jobs while they're waiting for trial, their homes, all sorts of things that can happen. And what this does is that, first of all, if you already qualify for electronic monitoring, this bill does nothing to change that. So if you have been charged with any type of sex offense, you would not be allowed now to be on electronic monitoring, and this bill would not change that. Here's how I would vision. The vision would be is that you would go to court, you would be there, you would have your the third party would be the electronic monitoring, they would be brought to court, it would be these things you have to do, and if you do all those things when you come back, and if you are then found guilty, you would receive credit for that, versus just sitting in jail and not being able to get the services that you may need. With that, I'll take any questions you may have, and we do have the Department of Corrections, and we have law here, and courts may be here as well.
Okay, it's time for questions, Representative Wilson, but also available we have Casey Schroeder from the Department of Law, Nancy Mead from the court system, and from the Department of Corrections, Carrie Belden is online, Director of Parole and Probation, and Deputy Commissioner Raymond Henderson is also available. So Questions? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wilson, just curious. So 1 day's, just kind of cutting through some of the legal language. So 1 day's time spent on a restricted movement ankle monitoring would equate to 1 day's jail time credit. Is that correct?
The Chair, Representative Sadler, yes, that is correct.
Okay.
Follow up?
I was going to say 1 day's ankle monitoring time for 1 day's ankle monitoring time I could see, but ankle monitoring for a day's worth of jail, I don't know. I've got to think about that.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Representative Wilson, to Finance. Oh, you're here. So if a person is not guilty until they're found guilty, and how can we go back and legally say that they have time served if they haven't been sentenced yet?
Through Chair, Representative Newman, we already do that. If you are charged with a crime and you go to jail, you are collecting time served every day you are sitting there waiting to be on trial. So that occurs now. What this bill would do is that under very strict portions by the courts, by the judge, if you do a counseling job, maintain where you are, I want to remind people that with the ankle monitors that they have now, they can tell you if you've taken even one drink. If you have a third party with you, I hate to tell you, but they have to sleep at some point. So we feel that the ankle monitors are able to monitor that in a much better way. So that is already occurring if you're in your jail. What this would do is if you're on electronic monitoring, you would get to count that day. And in my opinion, and it's solely my opinion, getting counseling, keeping a job, doing something constructive versus sitting in jail where, at least for Fairbanks, you have a place to sleep, you have cable TV. I can't tell you how the food was. I didn't try it when I was there. You know, but you don't even have to go get your food. And you get to socialize and all those others. You know, maybe I'm not seeing the same thing as in Arizona where maybe you just get bologna sandwiches. But I want to see people quit coming through the doors at $158 a day versus this being $20. And as you'll see is that you're not just sitting home playing games. The other question that I have received, Representative Newman, was, you know, this is going to prolong and people are going to want to stay on the monitoring and prolong their case being done. Once, if you are found guilty, you can then go on electronic monitoring through the Department of Corrections and receive day for day. So that happens once you've been convicted. What this would allow is for pretrial to have that same opportunity underneath very strict provisions.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would love for this to be a Wilson Geddes Guerra bill just to mess with people, because
Representative Guerra, through the chair, if you must, there are other options.
I don't have to be. I can start asking you some hard questions.
I'm ready.
Okay. So the language we use matters, right, in this bill. I mean, if we get it inexact, the people that you want to benefit from this bill aren't going to get the benefit, and the people you don't want to benefit will get the benefit. In Section 2 of the bill, the language is sort of it hurts my head right now, but maybe that's how it has to be written. It says you will lose your right to this time served if the person has not committed a criminal offense while under electronic monitoring and the court imposes substantial restrictions on the person's freedom. And I guess Part A is easy. If you're under electronic monitoring, you follow the law, you do what you're supposed to do, we're going to give you time served, it's going to save us costs in our criminal system. But the second part, which says you don't get it unless you had substantial restrictions on the person's freedom, well, what happens if you have something like just short of substantial restrictions? You've done everything right. You've gone to job training. You've gone to college. You've gone to work. You haven't drunk. You haven't done anything wrong. You're not going to get time served? If I don't know what substantial restrictions means, and what happens if somebody has like almost substantial restrictions, right? So why are those terms being used, and why are we not helping people stay out of jail if they don't meet that technical definition? And I don't even know what that definition means, frankly.
Through the chair. First of all, it has to be substantial. Otherwise, there has been court cases that said that, it's my understanding, somebody went to Weight Watchers and they got to count that as jail time. Right. And that would not be my intent. And I did not make that up. So, you know, again, the way it is pictured is that it's not for me to determine or you to determine whether or not it's substantial. When you go to court on your charge, that will be determined on page 2 on the court appearances, whether you're going to be going to a job, whether you're going to, what kind of counseling are you going to go to. It's, I kind of reference this, if you go to the emergency room before they let you out of the hospital, they send a sheet with you of all the things you're supposed to do and who you're supposed to call. So you know what you're supposed to do. When you walk out, you will know what you were expected to do on that ankle monitor. And if you break it, I would hope that you would be thrown in jail. Because it doesn't work if we're not serious about it. And the part that hurts your head was not a part that I added. It was law. That basically says, and again, I don't know why you have to include it, because if you break the law while you're on the ankle monitor, it didn't, you know, take care of the substantial portion of abiding by the law. But it does say if you break another law, shoplift or something, while you're out there, of course you're not going to get credit for the ankle monitoring, because again, it's trying to help people get back on the right track.
Follow up, Representative.
Yeah, through the chair. I don't mean to give you a hard time, Representative Wilson, but it's not good enough for me that the Department of Law told you to put this in here, because frankly the Department of Law tends to be a little harder on defendants than some of the other agencies. And so,
Representative Garrett, we do have people from the Department of Law here if you want to ask any questions further than
I will want to hear from the Department of Law and the court system, but let me just give you an example. You've been given an ankle monitor to make sure you, so we can find you, to make sure you're not doing bad things, to make sure we can find you to see if you've been drinking, to make sure we can find you to see if you've been dealing drugs. But let's say you've got an ankle monitor and they've said, you know, the cheapest thing to do is let you stay at home, but we're going to keep an eye on you. And you have to go to work, and you promise you're going to go get your GED, and you have to go do that. So you're living at home. You go, you're doing your GED work, you're doing your work. That's not a substantial restriction, but I would want that person to get time served. I mean, why are we not helping that person?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, it is my understanding, because there has been a court case that doesn't allow it to be just that way, that it has to be a substantial. It has to be somewhat equivalent to being in jail. And that's what we're trying to define here, is that equivalent to being in jail.
Mr. Chair, I've got a lot of questions on that, but I'll ask the other folks.
Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it happens from time to time. My colleague across the way with the same initials, I happen to agree with him, and I also think that originally when Representative Wilson and I talked about this was the very reason that we talked about, that folks that have done had bad behavior should have an opportunity to get themselves out. Now, if they don't and they go back to jail, hey, at least the opportunity was afforded. It hopefully was afforded where nobody else has to bear the brunt, so that you know, their bad behavior does not continue. But what we see, and certainly in my district, I see people that have made a mistake. They're human. They recognize a mistake, but they can't get out of the hole. And we have not afforded them any route to get out of the hole, as they continually cost the state more and more money. And we're not doing what originally we said that we wanted to be done. In jail, hey, they can do whatever they want. They really don't have to do anything except exist. And I don't think that's what we want for our citizens when they've made mistakes. We want them to work themselves out of the hole, to go get that GED, to go be a citizen that that is able to give back to their society, and to basically get out of the hole and get on level ground so that they can learn the error of their ways and move forward. I think that was the initial intent of this bill, and I agree with my colleague across the way that I think that sitting in jail is not the answer. And I don't know that it should replicate jail, because quite frankly, what we've been doing hasn't been working. So,
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, and forgive me for if I'm repeating a question, if I am. Representative Wilson, substantial restrictions on mobility, should I interpret that to mean, is a substantial restriction all the subsequent limitations of a person's movement to court appearance, meeting with counsel, et cetera, or are there other restrictions that are included in substantial restrictions on movement?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, those are the ones that there would be. It would be up to the judge to make even which of those provisions. So you wouldn't even automatically get all those things that are stated. Those are just items in the toolbox for the court system to be able to utilize depending upon what charge you have been brought forward with.
So just the feedback. So those could be considered and decided by judge, and there could be additional ones beyond that.
Representative Sandler, through the chair, I don't think you could go additional to those. It would be within those realms.
Well, so that's the entire universe of substantial limitations to movement.
Representative Sandler, through the chair, yes, these would be the things. Okay. And even to go with this, maybe only one or two of those would be, and let's say all of a sudden you change jobs, you would have to go back and you would have to, you know, get a different court order that it's changed. So you're not going to get to make those choices. Those choices are done by the courts.
Gotcha.
Mr. Chair, on that point.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative Wilson, one of the biggest issues that I've had to look at when we're trying to recidivism reduction groups and things that I've worked on is different judges tend to impose different terms and time limits for the same crime across the state. It's not a fair system, but you know, with different judges. So my question is what is substantial, you know, restrictions, and wouldn't it be better maybe as the Department of Law has a definition of what substantial restrictions are, but to me it'd be better, I think, if we kind of script what those are so that you don't have judges across the state imposing different restrictions and fines for doing the same thing across the state, because that's been one of the major problems, I think, within the correction system. So I don't know. I know you've thought about that. You work hard on your legislation, but how do we deal with that?
President Newman, through the chair, imagine this, getting the Department of Corrections, the public defender, the district attorney, and the court system all in one room sitting at one table. Good luck. You know, nothing personal. But, you know, as you change one thing in the bill, one of the other three doesn't like it. You know, you do another. So, you know, this really has been kind of like a compromise of what's substantial. What Representative Garrett said, I personally, if this was, I know it's my bill, but kind of not like anymore. But if it were, I would say take it to the courts, let the judges determine what they need to do with some consistency, because you're absolutely right, Representative Newman. Sometimes the draw of the judge that you get may be one that is more willing to work with someone versus someone who thinks everybody should be locked up. I think you have them from both extremes. But there was a court case in which, the legislature rewrote a lot of the laws at that point because of it. And what I was trying to do is to make make it so that all the parties could live within it, because we can make all the laws we want here, and if those four entities don't want to do it, it's just another law on the books. I think this also shows the community that we want to make sure everybody is safe and what they do. We're not expecting them to be just going around and doing anything they want and going and partying and not having some type of real restriction to it. And so I think this is, it looks really tight, but I think it's loose enough for the judges. My concern, though, Representative Newman, is making sure that it's in writing, because our other question has been, what if when you come back up again, you come to another judge? And that judge says, Judge 1 wasn't substantial enough, and we're now not going to give it to you because I would have done something different being the judge. So having it in writing, I think, will help. I think we're going to have to follow this closely to see if it needs to be tweaked. But we need to do something. And it's not, for me, it's not just because the jails are filling up. It's because I want to stop the cycle. Because the cycle is not just with that one adult. It's with the family that adult has and keeps going generation to generation. And we don't have what we need in the jails currently, especially pre-trial, to help someone get back on track when they still can get back on track. And that's really what I'm attempting in this bill, is to say, I don't think it's all that tough. And I've spent months in jail, so maybe I just don't know, but I spend months here and it feels like jail, you know. But if you make the monitoring to where it is substantial enough, people are still losing their freedom, and they're not able to, every time they open that door and want to go somewhere, they're going to have an ankle monitor that says, I can only do this or else I'm going to be back in jail. And that's why we have these provisions, is so that it is a deterrent to going back before. But we want them to do something as well than just sitting on a bed and watching whatever the cable TV has on that day. Thank you.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, and I came in late. I don't think the question I'm going to ask has been asked, but, you know, never having sit on judiciary, for me, some of the definitions are important because I don't know how they define them. So I am concerned about what is a substantial restriction or imposes substantial restriction. But I'm also concerned about if a person has not committed a criminal offense. Now, the judge could say you can't drink, you can't have pot. Both, neither one of those are criminal offenses. So the judge, so you're eliminating anything that isn't a criminal offense, but restrictions that the judge might have in the court. Is am I reading that right? That you're eliminating things that the judge might say are restrictions, and you're just having it criminal offenses. The judge might say you can't go near your ex-wife, you can't go near your somebody at work that, you know, you beat up because of this. You can't. Those are not things that are criminal offenses, but they are restrictions. So how are we dealing with those?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, I think you're confusing what's in lines 11 and 12, which just basically says that while you're in the ankle monitor, you can't commit another crime and expect to get any time served while you're on the ankle monitor for charge number one. That's a whole different piece of it than the substantial portion of it. And how we're defining substantial is when you turn to page 2 and it's inclusive of these items and what the judge says you can and cannot go to. And they can absolutely say that you can't be within 1,000 feet of if it's, you know, that type of a charge. But it's going to define what work is. You can't just say, I'm going to go to work every day. They're going to know what work is, where what hours you have, what place that's in, you know, what time you need to be back home, you know, or the residence that you're going to be in at that time, where your counseling sessions are, what time those are. This is very clearly defined in a paper that you can't just say, I'm going to go to counseling, and you go pick your own and determine your own time. The courts are responsible to know where you're going to be at, or the person who's doing the monitoring in the written statement.
Mr. Chair, I understand that, but my question is criminal offense. This excludes conditions that it looks like, because I don't know what the rest of the statute looks like, that you could exclude other restrictions by the judge, and if those are violated, they wouldn't count towards the ability to do time, get the time served. So, like example, you judge says you can't smoke pot, you can't drink, you can't drive, you can't any restriction that's not criminal, but a restriction by the court. You're not including them in this list of things. You're just saying criminal offense.
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, I don't know if I need a lifeline here because I don't know whether I'm really understanding your question. Because when you're talking about a criminal offense, I mean, you've been arrested because of a criminal offense. I mean, you broke the law is why you're in front, you know, you're in front of the judge in the first place. So let's say you had a potential alleged DUI. I would imagine that the judge at that point would look at that it was an alleged DUI and would pick an ankle monitor that was going to monitor your alcohol consumption. They would send, you know, if you wanted to do a treatment program, it would be a treatment program that had to do with your drinking habits. You know, keeping your job, you would have to be able to show you already have a job. So, you know, the criminal offense portion of that, and maybe I've got a help-up page here. Violating a bail condition is also a crime, according to law. So,
the condition of bail?
Yes.
Okay.
Hopefully that answers, and we do have a little help. Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way I read the bill, the things Representative Sadler asked about on page 2, court appearances, meeting with the counsel, and then the rest of page 2, those do not count as substantial restrictions. I thought I heard you say those are examples of substantial restrictions.
Representative Guerra, through the chair, your substantial restriction is you're going to be told where you can and can't go and what you can and can't do in those places. That's as substantial as that it's not allowing you to be able to just leave the residence and go anywhere you want. It's on your movement is where the substantial portion is. Within that substantial, these are the places in which would be on the list to be able to do. But the substantial part is actually making it to where your movement is very restricted.
Through the chair, I just want to clarify so everybody understands, unless I'm reading it backwards, that these things on page 2, 1, 2, and 3, those don't count as substantial restrictions. That's what the bill says. The bill says substantial restrictions, and they include things except for, and then it's 1, 2, and 3.
Representative Garrett, through the chair, I'm not an attorney, but the way I read this is that those are the reasons that you can be outside of the residence. You can only be outside of your main place if you are doing these things as determined by the courts. So otherwise, if you are not doing 1, 2, or 3, then you better be in the residence that you have on file.
Through the chair.
Follow up, Representative Garrett.
I think we're going to have to maybe ask some other folks too, but it's mind-boggling to me that we would treat somebody more harshly if their crime is so minor that they're not placed in a residence, but they're allowed to live at their own home, and they've been given more minor restrictions on their movement, but they do everything right. They're wearing an ankle monitor. They're under electronic surveillance, and we're telling them they don't get the time served, whereas somebody who's done something worse and is more dangerous does get the time served. And so that goes back to why are we using this term substantial restriction, and I'm positive that the things on page 2 don't count as substantial restrictions the way your bill is written.
I'm just going through the chair. You almost kind of made my point. I mean, right now, if you're sitting in jail, you're going to get credit. If you go in and you're on an ankle monitor where it's telling you where you can and can't be and that you have to go for treatment, you have to have a job, and you have to do those, to me, those are more restrictive, more substantial than if I'm just sitting in jail doing nothing. You know, hiding under my cover and sleeping all day long, I'm not required to do treatment, I'm not required to go outside and do anything, I'm not even required to go get the food because it's brought to me. So, you know, we can get in a discussion all day long on, you know, which is worse, and I'm sure everybody would have that. I think as long as you are on a monitor and you're keeping even a couple of these things, yes, substantial makes it the bill a little bit more difficult to understand, but it's and we might want to bring law up for a little help because I think I probably need it right now, is that was due to another court case that we lost, and they said that if we're going to allow something like this, it has to be substantially or equivalent to being in prison or in jail. And what we're trying to do in the bill then is what we end up doing is trying to define what that means. You know, where should I be able to go? You know, what should I be able to be allowed to do? And that will be determined by how, you know, what charges that you have. And depending upon what your charges are, you may not even be eligible to do this because there are certain crimes currently that you can't do the ankle monitoring before you're convicted or even after you're convicted. Remember, you were going to sign on a while ago. Can I sign the green slip for you?
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it will be instructive to speak possibly with somebody from law or corrections who can answer the question. To the question of is ankle monitoring more restrictive or less pleasant or more punitive than confinement in jail pre-sentencing, I think we might get at that if we found out the number of people who were eligible for ankle monitoring and release who took it versus those who did not. Can someone from law or corrections answer that question?
Let's see if we can get them both up here. Ms. Schroeder, Ms. Mead, if you guys could please come up, maybe you can answer some of these wild questions. We'll see who's going on here. Well, we've got people up already, Ms. Mead.
Remember, so. Change is hard.
Place yourselves on the record, and whoever would like to answer the question.
For the record, my name is Ramon Henderson, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections.
Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General with the Criminal Division at the Department of Law. I'm not aware of how many people would be eligible. That would be a DOC question, so I'll let Mr. Henderson take that one.
Thank you.
Up to
right back at you.
Right. Through the chair, I can tell you right now that in the Department of Corrections, these are post-sentence now. We have 457 people that are on electronic monitoring. We have 1,875 people that are in pretrial status. Of those, I cannot tell you how many of those would be eligible for electronic monitoring. I know that it is our goal to move people out of that are on post-sentence to move those people into electronic monitoring and CRCs where possible. But this is dealing with pretrial.
And through the chair, Representative Sadler, I want to, and I didn't say this before, most of this monitoring is done by private entities. They're not done by the Department of Corrections. Department of Corrections can, but it's been their practice not to compete with private business, and I'm glad they do that. But I know that the hopes is to look at other communities that currently, you know, do not have that ability.
Representative Sadler has a follow-up.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Henderson, you threw a lot of numbers out there. You said post and pre. I was trying to differentiate post. Can you try and give me a consistent answer of the people? Can you answer the question specifically pre-sentenced?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I cannot tell you the number of people that would be. Well, I would think that. Well, I can't tell you that. I can just tell you how many people are in pretrial, and that's
it. If you can't do that, then let's just go to post and find out how many people after conviction. How many people are eligible for release on ankle monitoring and who take it versus those who don't? And the question I'm trying to get to is, do people see ankle monitoring as an easier sentence than confinement?
Through the chair, the director of probation and parole is online, I believe, and she might be able to answer that question.
Ms. Belden, are you there?
To the chair, yes, I am. Thank you.
Yeah, place yourself on the record, and Representative Sadler has a question.
Hi, my name is Carrie Belden, and I'll be testifying on behalf of DOC.
Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Ms. Carrie Belden with DOC. My question is, I'm trying to get to whether people who have been convicted of whatever offense will tend to view confinement in jail as being more or less attractive an option than ankle monitoring.
Through the chair, I really can't answer that. I think that would be kind of a personal preference and a financial preference, and whether or not they have a legitimate place to reside and are even capable of doing electronic monitoring.
Then, if that's the case, can you tell us the number that are eligible that are or are not taking advantage of electronic monitoring?
Through the chair, I believe Mr. Henderson said that there are 1,800 inmates right now in custody that are in pretrial status.
Okay, then there's 1,800 in custody and pretrial, and again, post-conviction, there's 1,800, I'm sorry, I'm getting confused myself here. 1,800 who and what?
Those are 1,800, through the chair, Representative, 1,875, those are pretrial.
1,875 people are in pretrial confinement. And do we know how many of those are? No, I guess we don't. I was trying to bring illumination to it. I have not succeeded.
Representative Wilson.
First of all, you can't really, Representative Sadler, through the chair, you can't compare post-trial to pre-trial, because if I've been convicted, if I'm sitting in jail again, I get what's called good time. I get credit depending upon how long I'm supposed to be there. So I get extra credit if I stay in jail. If I go on ankle monitors, I don't get that good time. I get just day for day. You know, so for some, you know, back to the restriction portion of it, there's more incentive currently for me to stay in jail once I've been convicted versus go out on an ankle monitor. But we were told that approximately 40% of those who are sitting in jail currently are there pre-trial or because of some type of issue
Violations.
Thank you. So, but I want to make sure that people realize, and this bill started talking about good time, and it was better to take like one piece at a time. It got very frustrating in you know, trying to come up with that. So to think that more people are not versus post-trial when you don't get the same amount of time going on there, it's not pre-trial here. We're just trying to even it out to where if I'm sitting in jail, I'm going to get credit. We think that if you're out there getting counseling, you're doing a job, and you're being restricted to your movement, you should get that same day for day as if you were sitting in jail.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's go back a step, unfortunately, but it keeps being referred to as this is a pre-conviction, pre-sentence procedure, but I just can't find Ms. Schroeder in 027 whether this bill is limited only to people prior to conviction and sentencing or also applies to people who have been sentenced.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, this statute, 1255.027, also encompasses the credit for spending time in a treatment facility, and it applies to people who are pretrial or and the treatment part will also apply if you're on probation and you go to a treatment facility. So this is a pretrial.
If you're on probation, though, doesn't that mean you've been sentenced?
To the chair, Representative Guerra, that is correct, but that part applies to the treatment facility credit.
I guess then I'll follow
up, yeah.
Ms. Schroeder, in Section 1 and Section 2, I'll just take your word for it. I reading the statute, I don't see it, but do Section 1 and Section 2 only apply if you're pre-trial? Because I just don't see where that's limited.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, yes, it does. If you're a post-trial, you are under the jurisdiction of the Department of Corrections, and they can place you where they would like to place you, including electronic monitoring with restrictions.
And through the chair.
Go ahead.
What if it's pretrial and the judge decides to place you on ankle monitoring, tells you you have to go do your GED work or go to work, be productive, but you fall short of having a substantial restriction on your freedom of movement? Why wouldn't we give those people credit for time served?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, if that is the direction that the legislature chooses, and that would be something that you, an amendment that you might want to make, I can tell you that the language substantial restrictions on the person's freedom of movement and behavior is the language lifted directly from case law. And so that will mean something to the judge. And there is it's those things that are like incarceration, there's criteria for that, and that's also in case law. And it's listed out. 1255.027, the sections that are not included in the bill, which refer to residential treatment, it's very well fleshed out what these restrictions are and what the residential treatment facility has to provide to be close enough to jail to get credit, just to get jail credit.
Finally, through the chair.
Go ahead.
So, Mr. Schroeder, are you telling me this is a policy call for us? So if we wanted to also help somebody with a statute who isn't as bad an actor and is required to go do their coursework of some sort, required to go to work, but doesn't have substantial restrictions on their freedom of movement, if we wanted to grant the same benefit to those people who haven't committed as serious a crime, that would be a policy call for us? There would be nothing stopping us from making that policy call?
I'm going to take this one. Richard Garrett to the chair. It is my understanding that if we were to take out that part about the substantial portion and on your movement, that likelihood is it would go back to the courts. It would not be seen as being given credit for it. I also want to remind you that those who do really bad things and not those who don't do so bad of things are both sitting in jail. Different times that they may get as if they're convicted, but we don't make a lot of differential from that. Again, you know, this has been crafted to make all four entities as content as they can be, and I want to make sure whatever comes out of this bill is that they'll want to use it. Otherwise, it's just another law. But substantial has been a very big issue, and it's kind of gone through what is substantial and to make sure that both the public defender's office thought it worked for their clients as well as the courts that it would work for theirs, and then we also had law weigh in as well. So it is my understanding that needs to be in there, and I want to make sure it's utilized.
Mr. Chair, can I ask the question of the Department of Law?
One more for the Department of Law?
No, okay. Same question.
Oh, same one.
Same question.
Representative Wilson answered it, but I wanted it from the Department of Law. Ms. Schroeder, if we as a matter of policy decided that you could get this benefit without meeting the definition of having a substantial restriction on your freedom, is that a policy call for us, or would that somehow make this provision invalid?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, whether or not people get credit, jail credit, for doing something pre-trial has been very well fleshed out in the court system. And there's a long line of cases that say electronic monitoring, you cannot get credit for that. It's not like jail. However, in this bill, the legislature is now saying, we understand that you want it to be like jail court system, And we understand that you've also said electronic monitoring is not like jail. However, we're going to go ahead and say that, yes, it can be under these circumstances. And it is a policy shift. There is nothing preventing you from making another policy shift if you wanted to, and we would, I guess, see how that plays out in the courts.
I'd like to have Nancy Mead from the court system come forward and testify to clarify the judge's role that we've been kind of kicking around a bit.
Hello, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Nancy Mead. I'm general counsel for the Alaska court system. And with respect to the judge's role, the way this would work is judges don't order people onto electronic monitoring per se. What happens is, and this is only pre-trial, a person has certain bail conditions, and if one of those bail conditions is, for example, that they have to have a third-party custodian, which is a fairly common one, somebody to watch them, some defendants cannot come up with a suitable third-party custodian because the only people they know are, for example, might have a criminal record or are just not willing to watch them 24/7. In response to that, it's the defendants. Defendants come forward and say, Your Honor, how about this? I'm going to hire this company to be my more or less professional third-party custodian. There are companies in some communities in Alaska, and not all, who then do put an ankle monitor on the person. And if a defendant proposes this as a way to get out of jail in Anchorage, Kenai, Fairbanks, Palmer, they can perhaps convince the judge that this is an appropriate way for them to get out of jail. And those companies establish for the judges that they're trustworthy and that they'll turn the person in, et cetera. The Department of Corrections does not do electronic monitoring pre-trial, so their electronic monitors would not, so far, would not be something that you're talking about yet. That might happen, and then it would fall under this bill. So I just want to say that the judges don't say you must go on electronic monitoring. When the defendant proposes it themselves, the judge then would write out an order. Okay, if that's what you want, here's what I can do. And the defense attorney would propose the order in keeping with this statute and say, I will answer to this company, and I'll stay out of these zones. I'll maybe stay away from the victim. There's all sorts of things that can be ordered. And I must stay in my residence except for my court appearances, meetings with my attorney, and my job and my treatment programs. And then at the end, and the person does that, the defendant does that and puts the judge on notice, because in a couple of months when you're sentencing me, I'm going to seek credit for all this time that I'm, by the way, paying the vendor to watch me. So then a couple months later at the sentencing, the defendant comes forward and says, I didn't commit any crimes during this time period. I followed all the conditions, and therefore I'd like to seek credit against my, for example, 1 year in prison, 3 months of it I already basically served. So I just wanted to clarify that the judge doesn't put people on EM. We don't have the authority to order people to do anything, whether respect to Department of Corrections or to, you know, go out and contract and pay somebody to do that for them. So I wanted to clarify that.
Questions to Ms. Mead? Representative Guerra?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Mead, do we have to only give this benefit to people who are on electronic monitoring who have a substantial restriction on their freedom of movement imposed, or can we also grant it to people who are out on bail, have an electronic monitor, and fall just short of having a substantial restriction on the person's freedom of movement? Could we delete that language and still give the person credit for time served?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that of course would be a question for Ledge Legal, but I would clarify that the fact that substantial restriction is in there is because it's in there for the treatment programs. Most of the statute is for getting time spent in residential treatment. But the court case that was referred to was, you can do what you want in the statute. You know, the court's position is we just apply whatever you say. You can make a policy call that everyone gets credit for the time spent before bail, whether they're on electronic monitoring or what they're doing. That is your policy call, and the court will apply that. So you can write what you want into the statute, and all the judges want is clarity as to what you expect.
Just finally, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Well, I'm thinking of somebody who does not have an alcohol or a substance abuse problem, right? They've sort of led not the perfect life, and you say, look, we're going to put you on ankle monitoring. You've promised you're going to go get your GED. And so there's no real substantial restriction on their freedom of movement other than they promise that they're going to be on ankle monitoring so we can find you. And they're going to do job training or GED coursework. I just don't – I'd like to benefit that person, too, even though they don't have substantial restrictions on their freedom of movement. Just because they don't have a drug or alcohol problem, I don't want to discriminate against them. So I guess what's your reaction to that?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I believe you can draft this to give credit to anyone you want to give credit to. As written, your person would not be covered, as I think you're pointing out, but you could write anything. And again, the courts would apply if you say you get credit for you know, going to the grocery store. We would apply whatever law. It's your policy call, in my view.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure if this question is best aimed at Ms. Barnes or someone else from Corrections, but what percentage of people who are assigned to electronic monitoring fully comply with the rather strict requirements based on the agreement? Is it something that people often, seldom, or never can comply with?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, and I don't mean to repeat myself, but again, the court isn't making anybody go on electronic monitoring, but if somebody proposes it, and then does get out on bail on the condition that they comport with everything that's required under the electronic monitoring agreement. I don't have a statistic as to how many do manage to comply, but it's quite high that these are defendants who are, again, paying a company a good bit of money every month to monitor them. And the companies are quite that are operating currently are careful about reporting right back to the court and to the DA to file a petition when somebody transgresses. And so the companies that are in operation currently are fairly well-trusted, quite well-trusted, or else the court wouldn't approve of them. And so it's a high level of compliance. But, I don't have a statistic on that.
So just feedback. So compliance is high. The cost to the participant is high personally, and the consequences are swift for violation of the terms.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I guess I'd agree with those characterizations.
Further questions? The committee seems to have no more questions at this time. Representative Wilson, any closing statement before we move on?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I will be around and to speak to everyone. I know this is a change in policy that we haven't had, but again, I want to remind everyone that we're about 101% capacity. Not just that, we also have people who are sitting in jail currently who might have been able to take advantage of this, not have lost their job, because nobody's perfect. People make mistakes. And if there's a way that we can stop this revolving door, I think this is just the first step to it. And I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. At this time, I'm going to set House Bill 15 aside. The next House committee meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, April 7th at 9 a.m. And at this meeting, we will be having an introduction of House Bill 148, an act relating to medical assistance reform measures relating to eligibility for medical assistance coverage, relating to medical assistance cost containment measures by the Department of Health, Social, and Services, providing for an effective date, and this is a bill by the governor. And with that, at 3:09 p.m., we are adjourned. Mm-hmm.